Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette on Wednesday, June 18th, 2025. Hope you're having a great day so far. Today on the front page is a very large picture under Community Spotlight featuring Marlo Coleman with the heading, "It fills you up with joy to see everybody come together." And there's a caption under this picture, Marlo or Lo Coleman talks Monday at Champaign's Douglas Park, where he recently held a Love and Peace barbecue, attended by hundreds of area residents. From Champaign by Luke Taylor. Champaign native working to bring back old school community events. When he looks at the city where he was born and raised, Marlo Coleman sees a need to make it into a community. Somebody just has to take the first step. You need somebody to do it. It might be the time now for somebody to do it, Coleman said. I might be that somebody. Coleman grew up on the north end of Champaign, attending Booker T. Washington STEM Academy and Centennial High School. He remembers looking for anything he could do as a kid, but finding the most options cost him money. Coleman sees a need even now, even more than now, to put on events for today's kids, as well as their parents and other adults hoping to connect with each other. If you want to form a positive community, he feels that people need a chance to learn how to be part of it. It's like teaching in a school. That's what you have class for, because someone might not know. You're in kindergarten. What's 1 + 1? You don't know, Coleman said, but by the end of the week, you're going to know, because we're practicing. That's why Coleman put together a Love and Peace barbecue that brought hundreds to Douglas Park on June 8th and is planning a back-to-school bash for July 27th. He had arranged a handful of similar parties pre-pandemic before concerns about gathering large groups put the events on hold, and now Coleman decided it was time to get it all back. Seeing it all come together, seeing the kids have fun, listening to the music, eating food, beating down the piñatas, running for candy, bouncing in the bouncy houses. It fills you up with joy to see everybody coming together, Coleman said. Once he got the ball rolling, Coleman found that plenty of people were excited to get together and help make the event special. Some folks donated their time, offering free face painting, haircuts, and braiding lessons, while others brought food and supplies off of a list Coleman made, all to be given out for free. Still, others brought stacks of dollar bills for kids to grab from the piñatas. Double Dutch was a huge hit as ladies showed off their jump rope skills, and Coleman is hoping to bring back more classic games at future parties, like some red light, green light, where slipping up makes you a target for water balloons. You start gathering people saying, "Hey, yeah, I could do this," or, "Hey, I could bring this to the table," he said. It kind of comes together itself. You'd be amazed. It gets a bit at the snap of a finger. Coleman hopes that this kind of positive event will give kids adults to look up to and help adults make connections so they know who to turn to locally when they need something done. He gives credit to the community for pitching in for the barbecue, but those close by him say Coleman has had a passion for bringing people together in that way since he was young. His sister, Valena Claiborne, believes he got it from their great late grandmother, Elise Milton, who raised them. "Our grandma used to have block parties where they would barricade the street, and the fire department would come out and open up the fire hydrant, and there would be music and food," Claiborne said. "It was a lot of fun, and that's the kind of stuff that we grew up with, that you just don't see anymore. Seeing him recreate that has been really special." Claiborne said that the organizing events like these are a genuine passion for her brother, and she hopes the community will see how much he cares. She also hopes that everyone will continue to do their part to help and keep making these parties bigger and better. All of his events are focused on unity, joy, and faith, and he specifically targets the Black community, Claiborne said. He wants to uplift the community and just create a safe space, a welcoming place for everyone, which is really sweet. Another big fan of Coleman's is his cousin, Mako Milton. He also credits their grandmother, as an inspiration for Coleman's work and says there is no more deserving person to get some attention and support from the community. This is always who he's been. I don't know him outside of that, Milton said. When it comes to his kids, when it comes to his community, when it comes to our family, he's always first to jump in and do what he can. Milton said that even when they were kids, Coleman would help out how he could, like with homework. Now that he's older, he's just taking everything to a bigger scale. I couldn't be more proud of him, Milton said. We don't necessarily come from money. We don't come from a lot of things, you know what I mean? So it's easy for somebody like us to get a level of success and go away and turn our back. He's done the opposite of that. If his plans work out, Coleman's events and community work are only going to expand. For example, he isn't really taking monetary donations for events because he doesn't want to manage the funds without more structure. If Coleman could get an official nonprofit organization started, he said he'd be able to pursue grants and have proper avenues to handle donations and get more people on board for the planning process. He just isn't familiar with the process of starting something like that and is hoping to find someone who can point him in the right direction. I'm in a position where I'm willing to grow and willing to receive the help I need to receive in order to make everything better, Coleman said. In the meantime, he's working hard on that back-to-school bash. I want to be the biggest one for the kids. I want it to be the biggest one for the kids, he said. I want everybody to come together. Also on the front page, an article from Urbana about OSF Healthcare by Jana Wiersema with the heading, Review Process Required to Revamp Hospitals. Members of the public will have a chance to weigh in on OSF Healthcare's plan to shift services away from its Urbana campus as the project goes through the state's review process. According to the City of Urbana's attorney, Matt Rochely, OSF will need to file an application with the Illinois Health Facilities and Services Review Board, which will consider public comments as it evaluates the proposal. Anyone can request a public hearing, Rochely told Urbana City Council Monday night, and typically with actions like what's being proposed, those public hearings are requested and they take place. And so we would expect that to occur in this case. That could be a city request. It could be a private request. In early June, OSF announced its intention to consolidate its Heart of Mary Medical Center in Urbana and Sacred Heart Medical Center in Danville to form one hospital with two campuses. The Urbana location will expand its behavioral health services while continuing to offer emergency services, inpatient beds, diagnostic services, labs, and other clinic offerings. According to OSF President J.T. Barnhart, the center currently has 30 licensed behavioral health beds and will add 10 by renovating two acute care units. However, he indicated that some services will be shifted to Danville or Bloomington. When asked which services will move, Barnhart said that OSF is still having internal conversations with team members about these matters. The company said that its plan will be implemented on January 1st of 2026, pending approval from the Illinois Health Facilities and Services Review Board. Board Administrator John Kearney said that OSF had yet to file an application as of Tuesday afternoon, and he expects a certificate of need will be required for this project. Applications that are deemed complete are posted at hfsrb.illinois.gov and can be found by clicking on Project Search. Additionally, a public notice of the application must be printed in a local news publication. Any member of the public may request a public hearing at which comments about the particular project will be recorded and made part of the information that the board will consider when deciding on a proposed project. Keary said, all public comments are welcome and considered equally. I expect there'll probably be a number of requests for public hearing, Rochely said. At the bottom of the front page, an article about REO Speedwagon with a picture of Terry Luttrell, who sang with REO Speedwagon from 68 to 72, performs with his band REO Classics to open Saturday's concert at the State Farm Center in Champaign. Luttrell was injured in a car accident Sunday afternoon after he says he nodded off behind the wheel while heading south on Interstate 57. The article is by Dave Hinton from Urbana. REO singer hospitalized after wrecking car on the way out of town. Luttrell says he fell asleep while driving on I-57. Terry Luttrell is spending a little more time in Champaign-Urbana than he had planned. The REO Speedwagon singer, who was part of Saturday night's concert at State Farm Center in which the band and fans said their goodbyes, wrecked his car Sunday morning on Interstate 57. Luttrell suffered a cracked sternum from airbag deployment and is recuperating at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Speaking by phone from the hospital bed, his hospital bed Tuesday morning, Luttrell said he expects to be in the hospital for the next few days doing rehab. Luttrell said he fell asleep while heading south near Arcola. I was able to get up and get out of the car, Luttrell said. The airbag went off and cracked my sternum a little bit. I have a little back pain and neck pain. It's nothing that can't be overcome. Luttrell said he was headed to St. Louis for business. The keyboard player from Luttrell's REO Classics band was traveling behind him. Luttrell didn't get much sleep before hitting the road, saying he signed countless autographs and concert at the concert after party. It was just sign, 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 he said. He left the party about 2 a.m. Another 40 autograph-hungry fans awaited him back at his hotel. I had people with Starcastle albums and REO albums. People were really friendly. You've got to take time for the fans, he said. He got to bed about 4:30 and then hit the road a few hours later. Luttrell said he felt a little bit sleepy when he headed out but thought he'd be okay. It just happened, Luttrell said. I nodded off. I rolled the car over and I woke up and I was in a cocoon because of the airbags. Unfortunately, it totaled the car. Luttrell was taken to the hospital and later learned that some of the nurses who tended to him had seen him at the concert the night before. He said the concert was a good show all the way around. You never know what it's going to be like, he said. Everybody in the band was excited. It was just a fun evening. It was exactly what we thought it was going to be. It was a one-off concert that will never happen again. To say that you were there was a pretty big thing. Luttrell said he was glad to have been a part of it, though the car rolling part he could have done without. And continuing on in our communities from Danville School District. Members also vote to lock phones at high school in Northridge. Board okays making interim superintendent permanent. And there's a picture of members of the Danville School Board and meeting attendees give interim superintendent John Hart in the center a standing ovation as he heads to the podium after the board voted unanimously at its meeting Tuesday to name him to the role permanently. In a busy meeting Tuesday night, the Danville School Board solidified the district's administrative team and approved a key policy decision going into next school year. By the unanimous vote, a board approved the removing the interim tag from Superintendent John Hart's title and elevating Markeisha Parker, currently Assistant Director of Human Resources, to the role of Associate Superintendent. Hart, previously an Assistant Superintendent, assumed the interim role in February when the board approved a separation and settlement agreement with his predecessor, Alicia Geddes, and placed her on paid administrative leave. Geddes had started working remotely the previous fall due to what she said were security threats against her and had not attended a school board meeting in person since October. She never returned to in-person work, even though the board requested that she do so in November. Board President Darlene Halloran said, "The vote signals to the community that we are moving forward." Hart, who earlier said he hadn't yet decided whether he wanted the job permanently, was definitive on Tuesday night. "I can assure you that I am up for this challenge," he said. "I feel like everybody is moving in the right direction, which it makes a huge difference for the district. I am ready to move this district forward." Parker is a 1999 graduate of Danville High School who began her career in the district as a teacher in East Park Elementary in 2005 and worked her way up the ranks, including three years as assistant principal at the high school before moving to the Urbana District as director of human resources. She returned to the Danville District in 2023 in the same role. "I've known since third grade that education was my calling," she said, after the board voted to promote her. "While change does not happen overnight, we're ready to meet the challenge. I'm eager to begin and serve the community with purpose and passion." In another key vote, again unanimously, the board approved spending about $70,000 to acquire cell phone pouches from Yonder that will be required for all students at Danville High and North Ridge Middle Schools. Students will be required to keep their phones in the pouches, which stay locked for the entire school day. During public comment, a parent of Danville High School expressed reservations about staying in communication with her child, saying she supported the general concept but wanted to know if students could be allowed to access their phones during lunch. In discussion just before the vote, Principal Jacob Brett said, "Representatives from Yonder told the company requires the pouches to be locked from bell to bell, and he supported the approach. As the logistics of making sure students' phones were unlocked and relocked over several quick lunch periods would be too cumbersome." Addressing the concerns, board member Chris Easton asked if students would still be able to email their parents from their school-issued Chromebooks at any time, which Bretz confirmed they would. Easton also confirmed with Bretz that the policy on the new pouches would be to punish the phone, not the students, and that it would be enforced by administrators, not teachers. The total is about $70,000, and it represents $42,742 for the high school and about $27,000 for Northridge, at a cost of about $30 per student. The funds are set to come from the district's Title IV federal grant monies. Brent said the pouches have an expected life of about 6 to 8 years. Board Vice President Kim Corley said she saw the need for the pouches, but was scared to death to spend any money in this district right now. She ultimately voted in favor. Board member Tom Halloran also asked Brett's and Northridge Assistant Principal Nathan Henderson how they might measure the results of implementing the pouches. Brett said he had several years' worth of statistics with which to establish a baseline and measure against. Easton asked if the students, especially at the middle school, would simply start skipping if they couldn't be on their phones during the school day, and whether the district was prepared to deal with an increase in truancy. "I wouldn't anticipate this would exacerbate truancy, but if it came up, we would address it and individually address with the problem," Henderson said. Let's turn now to J. Mark Powell's Holy Cow History. And with his article is a picture, a large picture, of President Gerald Ford presenting George Danzig with the National Medal of Science at an awards ceremony on October 18, 1976, at the White House in Washington, D.C. A tardy student turned genius. Always be on time, we are taught. Promptness is, after all, a virtue. But one time, being late paid off spectacularly for one tardy student, and we are all the better today for it. Here's how it happened. George Danzig was a math whiz. We're talking scary smart with numbers. Growing up as a kid in the 1920s, long before personal calculators were ever dreamed up, he figured out difficult problems the old-fashioned way, with pencil, paper, and brain power. Danzig was born into a family of Jewish academics. His parents met as college students at the University of Paris. His dad went on to become a mathematician and his mom a linguist at the Library of Congress. George followed in their scholastic footsteps. He earned his undergrad and master's degree in mathematics and physics, then did a 2-year stint as a junior statistician, at the incredibly fun-sounding Bureau of Labor Statistics. But academia still tugged at his heart, and by 1939 he was back in the classroom, this time at the University of California, Berkeley. Danzig had a reputation for being a diligent student, often studying far into the night. One particular night Late in the year, he worked longer than usual, and he overdid it. The result was the same crisis college students still experience today. He overslept. Throwing on his clothes as fast as he could, he dashed across campus, thinking that he might at least catch the final portion of his statistics class and explain what had happened to his professor. But when Danzig entered the room 30 minutes late, it was empty. Two math problems were written on the blackboard. Figuring it to be the homework assignment, he dutifully copied them down and returned to his room. They were a little harder than usual, he acknowledged later, but he jumped into both with his usual scholarly gusto. In fact, he did little else but work on them for the next few days. When the homework was finished, he turned it in, along with a sheepish apology for having missed the class. A while later, there was a knock at his door. Danzig opened it to find his instructor, Professor Jerzy Splawniman, bubbling over in nervous excitement. "That wasn't a homework assignment," he said. The professor had written out two of the most intricately complex unanswered problems in the field. Their solution had evaded researchers for decades, and you just solved them both. It was an accidental success, and it launched Danzig's amazing career. His discoveries had major benefits, both practical and academic. They helped shape the course of modern mathematics and had a profound influence on early computer science. If you're reading this story online, Danzig was one of the people whose work helped make that technology possible. He put his talents to use in the U.S. Army Air Forces during World War II, where he served in planning and logistics. He eventually became a professor at Stanford, and his work was used to develop tools that revolutionized and the optimization of large-scale systems. The capstone of his career came on October 18, 1976, when President Gerald Ford presented him with the prestigious National Medal of Science. It was a long and distinguished academic journey that not only yielded many valuable results, but also inspired hundreds of future researchers. And George Danzig owed it all to oversleeping and mistaking those two examples of unsolved problems on the blackboard for homework. And we have time for another opinion piece by Jim Dye with the heading, Appellate Justices Stand Pat Waiting for Supreme Court Ruling. It's not often that federal appeals court justices throw up their hands and say an issue is above their pay grade, but that was the action taken by three justices on Chicago's Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals who were challenged by a Wisconsin school board to overturn a controversial precedent. We declined an invitation to overrule Whitaker v. Kenosha Unified School District because the existing circuit conflict on this issue will remain until the U.S. Supreme Court or Congress steps in, wrote Justice Diane Sykes. What's the issue that the nation's 13 federal appeals courts are so at odds on that they're passing the buck? It's a sexual discrimination issue, a relatively new one that resonates sharply in our current political atmosphere. It involves transgender students who wish to use the public school bathrooms reserved for the gender, girl or boy, whose identity they embrace. Public schools, among other institutions, are grappling with this issue across the country. At some point, given the conflicting legal opinions that govern the 13 federal circuits, a higher power is going to have to break the tie and establish a uniform national policy. The lawsuit was brought by DP, a transgender girl attending middle school in Mukwonago Area School District in Wisconsin, and DP's mother, who was identified as AB. There are substantial backstory to this controversy, but the bottom line is that in response to calls and emails from parents about DP's use of the girls' bathroom, the district established a new policy. It required DP to either use the boys' bathroom and locker room or a gender-neutral alternative. DP's mother filed a lawsuit alleging that the school's policy violated DP's rights under the Title IX of the Education Amendments in 1972 and the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. U.S. Judge Lynn Adelman first issued a preliminary injunction blocking the school district from enforcing its new policy. He followed that with a permanent injunction, challenging the judge's procedural approach rather than the merits of the judge's decision. The school district appealed. The district argued that the judge erred when he ruled against the district without holding a hearing. Error? Absolutely not in this case. When there was no facts at issue, a judge is not required to hold a hearing. In this case, the school district expressly relied on the factual submissions in DP's motion and never submitted its own evidence. Adelman found these undisputed facts showed the district acted in violation of gender discrimination law. The appellate court agreed he acted within the rules. An evidentiary hearing is not always required prior to the issuance of a preliminary injunction. Though the procedural rules contemplate a hearing, the court may proceed without one of the opponent's response if it's not suggested the existence of a factual dispute that might affect the resolution of the motion, Sykes wrote in an 11-page decision. DP's fight with the school district occurred in 2023. The appeals court ruled earlier this month. In a footnote, Sykes wrote that a forthcoming U.S. Supreme Court decision may affect the analysis of DP's claims. The case she cited is United States v. Scrimeti, which concerns whether a ban on gender-affirming care for minors under the age of 18 violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. And lastly, in our local news, from the Champaign County Court by Luke Taylor. Urbana man takes plea deal in hotel shooting case. An Urbana man pleaded guilty to aggravated battery and saw charges of attempted murder dismissed after he had been accused of shooting and robbing a man in a Champaign hotel room. K. John D. McFarland, 27, also saw one count of armed robbery dismissed as part of the plea. Champaign police responded to the Days Inn on West Bloomington Road at around 11:30 p.m. on June 6, 2024, for report of a shooting, according to State's Attorney Julia Reitz. On scene, they found a man who had been shot in the abdomen and transported him to a local hospital. A man who was renting that room told police he and the victim were hanging out when they were joined by three other individuals, two women and a man. The two women told police that the man was with them was McFarland, and that the two men who were originally hanging out at the hotel did not know him. At some point in the evening, the group left to purchase alcohol from a nearby liquor store and then returned. One of the women told police that she was outside the hotel talking on the phone when she noticed McFarland also outside, ripping a hoodie to cover his face. Reed said. The woman said she then heard gunshots inside the hotel and saw McFarland run out from the building. After surgery, the victim told police he could not identify the man who allegedly entered the room with his face covered, stole a backpack of cash, and then pointed a gun at the victim's head and pulled the trigger. The gun didn't fire, but the man re-racked it and it shot the victim in the chest, he said. The woman who reported seeing McFarland leave said he threatened her over text and told her to leave. Reitz also said that surveillance footage showed McFarland and the four other individuals near the hotel before the shooting. McFarland was arrested on September 15, 2024, after Urbana police conducted a traffic stop on a vehicle that he was in. He had been about to go to trial when he opted to accept a plea deal. McFarland's sentencing hearing is scheduled for August. And continuing on with the police report, from Rantoul, suspect in October Rantoul shooting is arrested. Rantoul police arrested 20-year-old resident on Tuesday for his alleged involvement in the shooting of a man in October. Mekki J. Ross was arrested on a charge of aggravated battery with a firearm. Sergeant James Schmidt said of officers were dispatched to the area on the 1100 block of Prairie View Drive at about 11 p.m. October 28th following a Raven gunshot detection activation. Officers found evidence of a shooting, including a shell casing. They later learned that the 50-year-old man had arrived at the area hospital and was being treated for what was considered to be non-life-threatening gunshot wound. Schmidt and Rantoul Police are asking that anyone who has additional information to please contact them at 217-333-8911. And we're going to take a short break now with the first half of this News Gazette, dated Wednesday, June 18th, and I'll be back in a moment with the second half.